This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode is Deputy PMQs Unpacked, Oliver Dowden and Angela Rayner going at it across the dispatch box. Before that, in the columnists, Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson taking a look at the day's news, including who reads the news. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits on Times Radio, live on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. It's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, as you may have seen in the news, the former Labour minister and then crossbench peer, Frank Field, has died at the age of 81. I spoke to him just over a year ago in one of the most extraordinary interviews I've done. He was so thoughtful and thought-provoking, talking about politics and faith and his own mortality. Here's a little clip.
I'm just happily waiting for the end. As I fear you may hear, the cancers move round in my neck and makes speech rather difficult, but I hope it's been clear enough for people to understand. But I'm just in good spirits, really.
Yeah, you really are. You're in very good spirits. Also, you're also
waiting for
crystal clear. I mean, it's interesting though, because it was some time ago now that you came out and publicly said you'd been told, I think originally, you might only have weeks to live. That's now been months, years. How has that been? Because I can't imagine what it's like if someone sits, your doctor sits you down and says, you know, Mr. Fields, we think you've only got weeks. And you probably go through all sorts of emotions and preparations and so on, and then those weeks become months and then become years. What's that been like?
Well, it's been rather weird that to be given prognosis of weeks and then of months. And now I think it's about a year and a half since I came out of the hospice and Molly Meacher announced in the debate on assisted dying, that if I had been well enough, I'd be in the chamber that day to vote for the bill. But I wasn't. But as you point out, I'm still here and much enjoying doing an interview with you.
And if you want to hear the full interview with Frank Field, just search for it wherever you're listening to this.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton.
And here they both are, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton, both in Burgundy.
Yeah, we did coordinate this week,
Okay.
Yeah. We're trying now.
Okay.
But I was shunned this morning because it is my birthday, actually, and I bumped into my son in the park and he'd forgotten.
Oh, happy birthday, Alice.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, but he'd forgotten.
Hang on, this is a way
he
of
ran
us
past
pointing
me.
Out that we haven't
yeah, you happy haven't birthday. Actually said happy birthday, but you're not supposed to. Your family is supposed to remember.
That's poor.
That's very poor.
It's got to be a big present tonight, I think.
So what, you were running?
I was running. And I bumped into him. Admittedly, I didn't actually recognise him because I didn't know he ran, but he's he aged 23. He has started running.
That could be actually be a bigger story than the fact that he not recognising your own
son.
Are
you sure it was him?
Is bigger than him not remembering your birthday.
He did eventually stop, but he didn't say happy birthday.
Oh. Does he live with you?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, she kicked him out, didn't she?
I kicked him out. Robert kept his.
Yeah. Well, maybe
Robert thinks he's a nicer person.
If you're going to kick him out,
Don't expect a big birthday treat. You're not going to get breakfast in bed if you've kicked him out.
The Kennedy thing's funny because like she's speaking on behalf of the entire family.
Yeah, so the entire...
I mean, that's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, if I hadn't made... I couldn't make an announcement on behalf of my... like the entire extended clan.
Well, so this is Kerry Kennedy, one of six siblings of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who on stage called Joe Biden my hero. And, yeah, so that they were all backing.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite sweeping, isn't it?
Yeah. They were all backing Joe Biden.
Family block vote.
Yeah.
Mind you, they are Democrats, and he's not running as a... he's an independent, so that's fair enough, really.
He's also a bit nutty, isn't he?
Yeah, from
sort
what I've
seen. Sort of anti-vaxxy and...
Yeah.
So that's why.
And you wouldn't want anyone to run, would you, in your family as a politician now?
Especially if your name was Kennedy.
Yeah.
If your name was Kennedy,
I mean,
then you'd
want to keep out.
They said, so Kerry Kennedy said, why nearly every... that's good. Nearly every single grandchild of Joe and Rose Kennedy support Joe Biden.
Right, right.
So that's how far back they're going. There we are. Right, let's talk about what we're actually here to talk about. The death of the news anchor. Hugh Edwards has gone. BBC facing criticism for sweeping its internal report about its conduct under the carpet, being said. But Andrew Billings written a piece in Times 2 today saying that... is he basically the last of the anchor men? The anchor men of America have already sort of passed.
Oh, he made the big three. Mm. He mentions that Diana's funeral, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Brokaw, Jennings, and the other one. Dan Rather.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce it? I don't know.
You haven't got, you know, it's not the same, you know, because Hugh Edwards didn't just read the news, he did the sort of great state occasions, cenotaph and weddings and all that sort of thing. Does it matter?
I don't think it does. I think the problem is that with them is that actually, although they did a lot, they were literally just sitting behind a desk. Not that that is what you're doing, Matt. But then
Kirsty Young, of course, got out from behind the desk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sat on it. And that was exciting.
Yeah, we do now have more diversity, don't we? I mean, we did have the Dimblebees and no one else for quite a long time.
Yeah, we didn't just have one gender or one class, we had one family. It doesn't bother me. To me, the news anchor died a long time ago. I remember the 1987 election, watching the exit poll on ITN. Sir Alistair Burnett, former editor of the Daily Express, knighted by Maggie Thatcher, could not keep the triumphalism out of his voice when he announced the exit poll, which had revealed Thatcher's latest win. And so the idea that there were these kind of all-seeing, kind of omniscient, impartial, kind of Moses figures guiding the nation was always a myth.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe it applied to Richard Dimbleby. I don't know. Respect to Richard Dimbleby. He, you know, but I don't, it was before my time, even before my time. So Alistair, but that was 87. Alistair Burnett. I didn't have any great feelings of reverence towards Hugh Edwards, and I think the whole story looks a bit shoddy to me. I think I read in the paper this morning that the BBC are saying, well, we've got rid of him, so now we've got no leverage over... The inquiry is just going to die a death, and we've got no leverage over somebody who doesn't work for the BBC. But depending on what he did, you've got leverage over somebody who's behaved badly. I'm not talking... it's not just the photographs. It's apparently behaviour towards other members of staff and numerous complaints which hadn't been addressed. And so it seems to me like it has been swept away, really.
I mind more actually about the sense now that we get quite a lot of MPs who want to read the news, and I think it's quite good that Ofcom's just come out and said that MPs can't do that, because you don't want people, as you say, who are biased reading out your news. You want someone who you actually don't know what they think, and I think the best news readers always did that you had no idea what they thought one way or the other. From.
And actually I think, because obviously because the news is still, you know, it still gets, you know, millions of people tune into the 6 o'clock news, the 10 o'clock news on the BBC. It's a mistake to think that people are tuning in for the person reading the news. It's not like it's Ant and Dec where, you know, they are the reason you're tuning in. Because you're tuning in because you want to know the news, and people still watch the news.
I think so, and they become a kind of, if they do it long enough, they become a bit of a personality by default, don't they? But it's not a great, I don't think it's a massive deal that we haven't, like, that we haven't got this sort of, this kind of godlike figure anymore. I mean, Andrew's, in his piece, nice piece, he's sort of slightly lamenting it. I don't feel that way.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that how demanding of respect they ever were.
The only thing, I mean, I was part of me thinking it doesn't really matter who reads the news, but there is something about, I find ITV's news at 10 a bit hard work. It's a bit sort of over, I don't know what it is, over-editorialised a bit. You know, they're trying to do the sort of American Walter Cronkite type vibe.
I've got to say, I haven't, I mean, this is part of the issue.
Yeah.
I haven't actually watched the news, you know, when it comes out,
either
10 o'clock, for a long, long time now. And I think that probably applies to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, I maybe watch it slightly on delay, or I watch bits of it, or I get it picked up here and there. But the idea that we all used to sit down and watch the 9 o'clock news and then the 10 o'clock news—that hasn't been the case for a long time. I don't think.
Also, you know the news. That's the weird thing. So that because everyone's either on Twitter or on Facebook, you sort of know bits and pieces of the news. So it's quite rare, or you get it on the radio just because you're driving along, you're doing something, or you know, when people have got podcasts, they've got so much. That actually, I'm amazed that people do sit down all together now and watch something, and particularly someone like 10 o'clock when you're actually by that stage, you're quite exhausted, aren't you?
Yeah. I remember actually somebody told me that. Hugh Edwards had started present. Somebody told them that their highest viewing figures were on the Sunday night, and so he started. He said, "Well, I'm going to start presenting Sunday night."
it's hard because you say ITN's a bit editorialised, but then what are they going to do?
They
can't compete on speed anymore, so they need to maybe author it a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly. It's an awesome author. Yeah. That's what the good word.
And then you, if you're not careful, you then turn into GB News or Fox News. Tricky one. I think it's possible. I mean, I think Laura Koonsberg does a phenomenal job of being kind of sparky, but not necessarily knowing what she thinks about everything. Or you couldn't necessarily predict what she thinks about everything.
And similarly, when it comes to general election night, there's a lot of speculation what's going to happen. I think Laura Koonsberg is going to present. I think that's been reported. You know, if you're going to watch the telly, or you might be listening to the radio, ultimately it's because you want to know what's happening.
Yes.
Not because you're particularly, you know...
You want to know the seats that fall, don't you? Yeah. Basically, that's what you're watching.
And as long as the person, if it is me, is telling you them in good time with some decent analysis.
Yes, it's a bit like watching a football match. You're not watching it for the commentary. And you want you kind
as
of
the it's best, not annoyingly bad.
No, you want them to sort of get out of the way, really, and maybe tell you something that you don't know occasionally, like with a royal wedding or something. Tell you things that you don't know about the
knights
or the garter or the corkies or the dress or whatever. But basically, they're there to sort of be unobtrusive. And David Dimbleby was quite good at that, wasn't he? He did it without imposing himself.
I always
like the fact that Dimbleby's, the mother said that she used to have a pad and she'd split it in half and she used to watch both programmes with both Jonathan and David Dimbleby and mark them. Can you imagine
mark them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's bizarre.
Well, it whiles away the evening, I suppose.
Yeah, well, quite tough, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. But I think the main thing is it's all about TV, and obviously what happens on radio is completely different, so that's all fun. Eileen's been in touch saying, when you cover TV anchors, I do hope you'll pay tribute to Ron Burgundy. We've got the clip. Here we go.
It is anchor man, not anchor lady, and that is a scientific fact.
Thank you for that, Eileen. Right, well, maybe they should all be replaced by AI. Everything's been replaced by AI, it seems. And Alice, you've written today, it's absolutely fascinating, this AI in recruitment, which I've been here for 8 years now, and I've had a proper interview sort of for a long time. But my stepdaughters go through this entire process now, and I'm amazed by, and then there's a student that I'm mentoring, amazed by the level, like the virtual hoops you have to jump through before you get to a human being.
What's extraordinary to me is when I wrote this piece that it is all about how AI is now used for job interviews, but I was talking about the young, but actually if you look at the comments underneath the piece, a lot of elder people are saying that. So if you're in your 50s and 60s, you get taken out by the AI because they don't want people of that age. And that is the problem. So that if you go through 8 or 9 rounds and half of them are with a machine, effectively, you get knocked out for all sorts of ridiculous reasons. And then quite often they're doing these interviews, particularly the younger ones, to a screen with no one there. It's just a bot, and you're actually talking into a screen for the interview, and then the bot decides whether or not you're smiling or not, whether you have to hit these trigger words. So it feels so impersonal. I'm amazed that they all manage to keep going, because it can take months to get an interview, and then the whole process can take about 9 months.
But also, the thing I find odd about it is that if you've already decided exactly what it is that you want, then... And then you sort of go down the road. You're not going to get the, we'll try this guy. Or get them in and we'll have a chat with her. And actually it turns out this is exactly what I didn't realise this is what we wanted. Well, that's actually, do you know what
I mean? Yeah, I mean, you said it's particularly bad at, or good if you at ruling out the kind of quirky, the eccentric, the humorous, the, you know, and there's something about doing some of it you have to do to a screen to yourself, you know.
See, all the interviews are done to yourself on a screen.
Right, so that's just rewarding kind of professional egotists and extroverts, isn't it? I mean, I think it's a shock. I mean, I was shocked by this, and another example of technology. It's becoming a bit of a theme with me. I don't want to sound like a dinosaur, but I sometimes...
Somebody has already been in saying we can add Alistair Burnett to the list of things to be John Vaughan Gethin picnics, sunshine.
I didn't mind Vaughan Gethin. It was a struggle interviewing Vaughan Gethin, but I didn't mind him. I thought he was a decent bloke.
So he's not on the list.
He's not on the list, no. Okay, but AI kind of is, actually. Yeah. It's an example of technology is good if it makes things better, but every example we heard in recent months and years is things... Technology making things worse, it seems to me.
Also, all these companies are using it. So over half of companies now use AI to try and pick people, and they're not using their HR departments, I think, enough. But then what's extraordinary to me is then they're turning around and saying to these people, you can't use ChatGPT, you can't use technology these forms, which seems insane because actually it works best. If you're up against AI, you should be using AI. So the cleverest candidates are doing that because you have to hit these trigger words. So if they say, are you a team player? If you're different, sensitive, or
you'd say
use lots of different words for team player, but actually what they want is you to say the word team player at least two or three times. And that just seems
it's
insane.
Really odd.
But somebody's written the AI, somebody's written the program.
That's what I mean. It's a classic.
So therefore somebody at some point must have said we don't want anybody over 50. Although we're continually told that we do want people over 50 and 60 to get back into the workplace, and we really do need them. So,
but I think part of the problem for companies is the sort of LinkedInification of the jobs market means that instead of, you know, in the old days, of course, you've been circling things in the newspaper or, you know, maybe looking online. Now you can just see any job advertised anywhere and really quickly apply for it.
Yes.
So you just, instead of getting dozens of, you know, response. You literally get hundreds. Even when we've like recruited, when I was running Red Box, you just get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds
bizarre because we're in a labour shortage at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a problem with filling vacancies.
Yeah.
It's why we need immigration. It's why we need people to be able to move to the southeast of England and sort the housing thing out. And yet you're saying that people are applying for jobs and it's taking them 9 months to get it.
I mean, most of the time they've got at least 1,000 applications for the big companies, finance companies offer.
Yeah.
I mean, over them, someone like McKinsey's has 1 million people applying each year for their graduate scheme. I mean, that's extraordinary all around the world because anyone can apply now, as you say. And they don't actually tell you exactly what they want. If they said more about what they wanted, then I think they'd, you know, they'd hone it down. But they're worried about saying, well, actually, this is the kind of qualities we really need. But I do think there are too many people. On the other hand, I think companies owe it to the young to actually go through their CVs and go through it. And even if it might take a bit more time or they need a few more people, they should be doing it. And they won't get the best people unless they do actually trawl through those CVs.
They owe it to themselves as well to get the talent and to fill the vacancies, certainly in this part of England, of the UK, there are lots of job vacancies. So they need to be filled more quickly.
And actually that whole thing of like, particularly if you're like building a team or you add into a team and you want that diversity, you know, just say we want someone exactly like that and you create the AI to then recruit exactly the same person without thinking, well, actually maybe we want something different.
But also if you're doing a lot of them are actual games that you're playing. So basically you're saying to your children, don't spend your whole time doing computer games. And then by the time they start applying for jobs, actually what they need to be is good at computer games. So that seems mad that actually what you should be training them for is to do these incredibly complicated psychometric tests. And what's the point in doing that? You know, what's the point in then giving them this entire education if no one actually cares about it anymore?
I just think the idea of having to sit and do your interview to a camera on a laptop, which a robot is going to then decide whether or not...
And a lot of the basics, even going back to the basics of a psychometric test, a lot of that, I mean, is this proven? I mean, a lot of that, it just sounds dodgy to me. It just sounds like made-up science.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like astrology.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Is that going on the list?
Do you know what I mean? Well, just stuff that has an internal logic to it, but is absolutely a crock of Yeah. Nonsense.
And also, that. I mean, I did try it with various people. There was one when I took, two senior civil servants in the end, and I said to them, look, this is the fast stream one. Can you do it? Both failed, and they were like under average.
Wow.
And you thought, if they can't perform well for the fast stream one, then who is going to? Because they know how
to perform.
So two
civil servants tried to apply for the civil service.
Well, I got, I showed them what the test was. Yeah. I said, look, this is the test. I didn't actually get them to put their names forward. But they both found it impossible to do. And they were scenarios like, if you're in an office situation. So they have all been in office situations. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, this story has caused quite a lot of consternation in our team because there's a generational spread between various members of the team. And it's been suggested that saying back in your day to an older colleague is the latest form of workplace discrimination. According to an employment tribunal in Watford, it ruled that... in favour of a nursing assistant in her 60s who sued for discriminatory dismissal after a younger colleague told her her procedure would have been free through the NHS back in your day.
Except, I think, sorry to interrupt, but it found that she didn't actually say it.
Oh.
But had she said it, it would possibly have been unlawful.
Very good. Well, it's good, important to clarify that. Mm-hmm. What do we think of this?
I think we do it the other way around as well, though, don't we? If you get more experience, or, you know, quite often we say to kind of younger colleagues, well, if only you knew X, or when we got sent to do that one. And so I think, it's quite a joke normally. That it depends how you say it.
I spent half of my life trying to educate the younger members of the team in important matters like, are you being served?
Yes.
Or, you know.
Inside leg measurements.
I'm free.
Yes, yeah. Young Mr. Grace.
All of that.
Mrs. Slocum's pussy.
Exactly.
Yes.
Try explaining that to a 20-something Gen Z from Australia.
Yeah. I think... This is really silly, isn't it? We can't be unlawful. I mean, you could say certain circumstances where it might be rude to say it in certain circumstances.
I am literally guilty of this. But it's not. But the idea I can't remember if it was Liz. I think it was when Rishi Sunak.
You said
the first time that Prime Minister had been younger than you.
Yeah.
And you said it happened to you before, and I said, what, Churchill?
Churchill.
And then on air, you told me to F off.
Yeah, which was the correct response.
It was the correct response.
But I shouldn't, the correct response would not have been to prosecute you. You're talking about the law, you're talking about the parliament legislating for people saying what my kids say to their grandfather every time they see him.
Yeah. Sorry, what my kids say to me every time they see me.
Yeah. I mean, it's just mad.
Running around the park.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think... you could see with the circumstances in which it might be a little bit rude to say that in a certain tone of voice or whatever. But it's entirely about context.
Yeah. And also, I would say on the tube, I now have started getting people standing up and giving me their seat. And actually, I'm not going to say, don't do that, or that's really rude. Because what you think is, you're trying to be polite and there might be another person who wants that seat. I don't actually take it because I do think, God, well, I'm obviously now 57, but I'm quite young.
Oh, is that right? I wasn't going to ask, but
But I suppose actually...
You're very youthful, 57, if I may say so.
Thank you. They shouldn't be giving me seats, should they?
No. I can see why it happens to me, but why it shouldn't happen to you. Back in my day, it wouldn't have happened to Alice.
Well, so it's all about context, isn't it, ultimately?
That's what I just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The if it's meant in a jokey, affectionate, you know...
Which it almost always would be.
Complimentary way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or like my children talking to their granddad.
Yeah.
Yeah? But if it's somebody being some really uppity 25-year-old being mean to some 55-year-old...
Because it's basically saying... This would have been... Because it was basically saying that this would be... This is all right back in your day.
Yeah.
You know, but get with the programme.
Yeah, granddad. That kind of thing. Yeah. That would be rude and possibly abusive, especially if they were more senior, if the younger person were more senior.
There are much worse ways of that sort of age gap war when you're talking about boomers and you're talking about Gen Z and then they don't meet in the middle, and that, you know, all that generational warfare, I think, you know, is much more than, you know, actually just kind of facing off, isn't it? It's all about housing and...
There's a big cut, we have bants about this with the youngsters in the office, and I have to be careful, you know, to not overstep the mark.
Do you?
Yes.
We're all on that learning journey.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, about housing. I'm not. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, anything else?
No. Good.
Yeah, but I mean, it wouldn't bother me if somebody said that to me, and then kind of increasingly they do.
You know, so. I've been very clear with the team. They shouldn't be using that sort of language with me.
Oh, really? You take more and more. Yeah. But I haven't really got a team. You see.
That's true. You want to get one?
No, I don't. Never want a team.
Lay down the law. No direct eye contact. only really communicated.
Have they actually
emails.
Said? Have they, I can see them there
yeah,
through
can
the glass.
Yeah.
See it, in there.
Just to just set the scene.
Yeah.
We're in. We're in. One, you know, in like
the
a studio
yeah,
thing.
Through the glass.
Through the glass, you see.
So
these,
shake off a hangover.
These youngsters, very young, grinning away with their Gen Z.
She didn't even hear that, did she? Because say what I like about it. She's not listening.
She'll be doing something on the internet.
Well, let's round things off. Let's round off this this long session of just moaning.
Moaning. This is great. This is debate.
It's debate where we all agree with each other.
No, well, I'm just. I'm, no, we disagreed yet. On the last one.
Yeah,
I'm being much more cool about it. If I'm going to say so.
Yeah, you can't use the word cool though either, can you now?
Can you not?
Well, no, I think
can you
aging.
Use it? Can you use it in relation to the thermostat?
Oh, what a pro!
Come
ding
on.
Dong, that's worth that. Yeah,
you've written about the thermostat and the war that's been waged in the Crampton household.
I always click it down a little bit. The thermostat. Mm. The context being that it's blinking cold for the end of April.
It is blinking cold.
Outrageously cold.
And you feel manly by doing it, don't you?
And there's machismo involved, and there's a certain amount of thrift involved. But there's also just being a dad involved. It's kind of what you do as a dad.
Yeah.
You turn lights off, you tut about energy, excess energy usage. Yeah. And that's okay. My dad did it. His dad did it. As I said, there'd be generations of...
Back in your day.
Back in my day, no doubt there were Cramptons saying, you know, you can't put any more dried cow dung on the fire, you know.
Who controls it in your household, Alice?
Well, it's the same, actually. It's the men. It's the one, I think the women just get colder. I say it's because we're probably slightly thinner. I think they've probably got an extra layer.
I don't actually control it. Let me be clear about that, because it's just as soon as I click it down a bit, it
is
goes.
So have you got a physical one on the wall?
Yeah, I got a little one on the wall.
So we've got an app, which means I can click it down wherever I am in the world.
Yeah, well, my brother-in-law
from the
does
office.
It, yeah, my brother-in-law does it from abroad. He decides his family's using too much heating in Edinburgh.
Lock it down. Yeah.
Well, we fight in the car over it. That's the other one. The car's a really big one because you can actually see each other doing it, can't you?
Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson then. Of course, you can read them at The Times every week with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, it's Deputy PMQ's Unpacked.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio, unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Tim Shipman.
Yes, and here he is, Tim Shipman.
Hello,
I've
Matthew.
Seen a lot of you in the last week.
Well, not as much as I've seen of you, having watched your stand-up act last night, which was excellent, I have to say.
Thanks very much.
You had a more amusing shirt on then, though.
Well, I did it at the pub.
Yes, you
did. I did one of my flowery numbers.
I have to tell people that the shirt in the pub was really quite amusing.
How is your big week for you? Book week this week?
Book week. Book is, No Way Out is published tomorrow, Thursday. We've got a couple of reviews in, which have been quite pleasant. So, yeah.
Very good.
Please go and buy it. No one's asking you to read it, simply asking you to buy it.
Exactly right. A sale's a sale. as Liz Truss will tell you. And joining us this week for Deputy PMQs and Patrick is Rishi Sunak is in Berlin. So Oliver Dowden and the lesser-spotted Angela Rayner will be at the dispatch box. And joining us, Callum McDonald.
Hello.
Off of breakfast.
Thanks very much for having me.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank
Taking
you.
Taking a rare break from your holidays.
Well, yes, indeed. I have decided to come to work, in fact, to do this and to do drive today as
what?
Well. Vroom, vroom.
Double dose.
Can you believe
You'll need
it?
A break.
I know. I'm booking one. Don't you worry. It's in hand.
Where were you at the weekend?
Paris.
Oh, nice.
It was lovely.
Oh, bonjour.
It was, well, absolutely. Merci.
It's just like being there, isn't it?
Really painting a picture with words together. What do you think will come up at PMQs? What will Angela Rayner go on? And will Oliver Dowden manage to turn it into questions about her housing situation?
Well, he'll have to, won't he? And being the Deputy Prime Minister and effectively being a guy who spent most of his career in sort of Tory attack dog politics behind the scenes, I think he'll relish the opportunity. I mean, all I would say is that, you know, this, everyone's sort of seeing this as, you know, sort of Hagler and Hearns as a proper big old exciting dust-up. And there's every chance it's very boring because the ones that, if Angela Rayner says as little about her situation as she has so far, then we might not get anywhere. And how long before Lindsay Oyle intervenes and says, this is supposed to be questions to the government, not questions to the deputy leader of the opposition. So we will see how he polices it. But you would imagine Dowden has got a very thick book full of stuff.
Stuff about her housing. I've just trying to remember when the last, because it's been a while since he stood it, because there was a period where Rishi Sunak seemed to be missing quite a lot of them, but he has actually done quite a lot. Was it wooden drivel? Was that somebody said there was an anagram of Oliver Dowden?
Yes, yeah, something like that. But I think, you know, what you'll probably see is he might go for the ridicule angle and joke about her not knowing where she lives and all that sort of thing, rather than forensically attack the specific details of it. And then they'll try and make that look sort of like an embarrassing situation rather than a sort of scandalous one. But, you know, who knows?
So I think they're sort of kicking off PMQs with tributes to Frank Field, who's died at the age of 81. And as you would expect, there have been tributes from politicians from all sides. Do you know Frank well, Tim?
I didn't know him terribly well. He's one of those people, if you phoned up, you've always got a straight answer. And he always knew an astronomically large amount about whatever it was you'd phoned him up about. Decent bloke. You know, not one of those sort of politicians who really played the political game very much. He was what, you know, he did what he said on the tin. And you phoned him when you wanted to genuinely find something out or if he was doing something interesting in terms of pursuing a particular campaign. He wasn't one of those sort of plotters or people who sort of make trouble or the kind of people who like sort of just rabbiting away to journalists. But he was a... He's what I call a proper person. He was, you know, I think respected on all sides of the house. I mean, and, you know, during the Corbyn years was one of the people who was prepared to call a spade, shall we say.
He, in the interview that I did with him last year, I asked him, somebody's mentioned in about this, I asked him, because he was very close to Margaret Thatcher and said he liked her and admired her and so on. And I said to him, what would the people of Birkenhead say to that? And he said, well, they'll have to put up with it, won't they? It was very, like, straightforward. Well, you know,
she admired him as well. Yeah. She thought he was a sort of serious person who was trying to come up with proper solutions to, you know, and a lot of the, I mean, some of the welfare stuff that the Cameron government did through Ian Duncan Smith, I think, you know, Frank Field had tried to do some of that, sort of rationalise what was going on with our benefits system years before, and kind of Tony Blair bottled it and pushed him aside. And from then on, he was a kind of a sort of voice of sense on the back benches. But yeah, he was sort of gone in to think the unthinkable in the early part of that new Labour government. And when he did so, he was promptly shuffled out again, which I think was a bit of a pity, really.
So we look ahead. So I think the reason we haven't gone to the Commons yet is because Jonathan Gullis, the Tory MP, has asked an extraordinarily long question, which is all basically to do with the local elections and attacking Labour, which the Speaker's now intervened and basically told him to shut up. So we'll go to the Commons. Do you normally watch PMQs, Callum?
I normally listen to this, I'm not just saying that. I will turn it on deliberately if I've not already been listening. I quite enjoy it. What I always want, and I think everybody wants this, don't they, is sharp, funny, clever responses with actual information in them. And they are all too often not. not those.
But actually, last week was pretty good.
Last week was good.
It was as good as it gets last week,
I think, to be honest.
Good, sharp stuff from both sides, actually. Short, sharp questions.
Whereas
from,
what I'm expecting this week is a bunch of hackneyed gags that don't land properly.
What on earth makes you think that? So, Angela Rayner is in the House of Commons. She's got Rachel Reeves and Lucy Powell sitting either side of her, putting questions to Oliver Dowden, Deputy Prime Minister, because Rishi Sunak is in Berlin. Still not. Come on, Angela, get up. What do you think she'll... if you were her...
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask that.
What would she ask?
She needs to just go on something pretty general and local election-y or turn her guns on Tory sleaze or something like that, I would have thought.
We can't go on sleaze. It's a bit close to home. Doesn't she like ask
if you're getting it yourself, you say, well, what's really sleazy is X, Y, and Z and get into all of that.
Does the question, has it been a good week for the government, play into how they do this? You know, on defence announcements, Rwanda kind of show of strength, all of that.
Well, they seem to be claiming there's a sort of black hole in the government spending plans on defence, which they can add to the abolishing of national insurance.
Say, last week.
Your black hole is now X billion large. I mean, what was it before?
46 billion.
46, add 75 now to that, and you've got, you know, 100.
It's a big hole.
It's a big lot of billions that they can wave around.
But you're right, they are doing. There has been a lot of activities. Yeah. Rwanda, smoking, defence and all that. Peter Manson on How to Win Elections said, you know, they are... Rishi Sunak does appear to be trying to answer the question, what is the point of Rishi Sunak? Mm. You know, doing a lot of things, having some arguments and some, you know, whatever, but some activity rather than just sort of drifting. Right, we are ready. Here we go. Let's go live to the House of Commons. This is Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner.
Speaker, and can I first of all share with the Deputy Prime Minister's comments regarding our Jewish community and a happy Passover, and also start by acknowledging the loss of David Markand and Baroness Massey, both of whom made historic contributions in this Parliament, politics and wider life, and also send my condolences following today's news to the family of Lord Frankfield, who is a good friend of mine and a colleague, and who was a tireless campaigner against poverty and a champion for his constituents. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I know the party opposite is desperate to talk about my living arrangements.
Wow. But, that's what you call getting ahead.
The public want to know what this government is going to do about theirs. Yeah. Natalie from Brighton has been served with two no-fault eviction notices in 18 months. She joins nearly a million families at risk of homelessness due to his party's failure to ban this cruel practice. Now, instead of obsessing over my house, when will he get a grip and show the same obsession with ending no-fault evictions?
Well, to begin with, it is a pleasure to have another exchange with the Right Honourable Lady in this house. Our fifth in 12 months. Any more of these, and she'll be claiming it as her principal residence.
Oh, God.
She quite liked that.
Could have been worse.
It may have escaped the Right Honourable Lady's attention, but we will be voting on exactly that matter later today. The Conservative government taking action.
Is that it? And now he's sat down. Oh, there we are. So, Angela Rayner taking the decision. They're going to bring up the question of her house, the house that she sold. Did she pay capital gains tax? Was she on the wrong bit of the electoral roll? The police are investigating it. She thought, let's just get ahead of it.
Mm. Let's go to housing.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Quite admire that. It's good. And actually, his joke, while you're being rude about it, as PMQ's jokes go, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
And she actually had a bit of a chuckle.
Yeah.
And the Education Secretary was enjoying it as well.
And Oliver Dowden, Callum, has spent years prepping people for PMQs and has seen as invaluable, particularly David Cameron, but others since. I have to say, we've always sort of said he's probably got better at writing the jokes than necessarily delivering them.
Yeah, well, I think he could take some lessons from you, Matt, having also seen your show this week, your stand-up show, on how to actually land them, how to land a joke. And it's one of those, isn't it, where the MPs behind him will cheer and laugh and jeer and laugh and all of that, regardless of how he delivers it, even if we're listening and going, oh, hang on a second, that's a bit flat. I agree with Tim. I think that was... it was a little bit more spicy than it could have been. I'm quite intrigued by Angela Rayner doing that, by leading off in it. Does that mean it goes away for the rest of this session of PMQs?
I suppose it then becomes harder for him to make a joke about it six times.
I mean,
that would probably not work anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, let's see if he goes after On the Substance at all.
I mean, he was clearly going to make that joke regardless as the opening encounter. And then on the substance of it, the long-awaited renters reform bill returns to the Commons today. Campaigners want stronger action to make the market fair for those renting. And in particular, there's this issue of no-fault evictions and trying to make it harder for basically a landlord to say, I want to put up the rent, or you're being a nuisance because you keep saying the shower's not working, so we're going to kick you out. There was some research, I think Sky News, 100 MPs have earned over £10,000 a year as landlords over the course of this parliament. So there's been some speculation. Actually, the reason why some MPs are slightly less enthusiastic about clamping down on this is because of their own financial interest. But it was quite clever the way she did it, Callum, going from her own situation. I want to talk about real people. This is what really matters.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think I like the kind of real people stuff that they build on because it does make it feel like you can connect to it. One thing I worry about the renters reform bill, is whether or not people have got a grip on actually all the things that it covers, all the various things that it would cover. We'll talk about it a bit later on Drive, actually, as it kind of returns to the Commons today. And all of that, the landlord groups versus the renters' rights campaigners who agree and disagree, it is one of those that's quite intricate. And I wonder if we will reach anything close to a satisfying resolution on it.
Well, let's go back to question number two. Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, he clearly thought he could spend all week obsessing over my living arrangements. I didn't even bother to read up on his own government's bill this afternoon. The reality is he caved in to vested interests on his backbenchers and delayed justice for people like Natalie. Yes. This week, the housing minister said there is no solid date for banning no-fault evictions. The housing secretary now says it won't happen before an election.
Michael Gove.
So if he can give us a date, can he name it now?
I can name the date for the right honourable lady. Today. It's today that this House will be voting on it, and I'm confident that in line with our manifesto, we will deliver on that commitment.
Well, he's keeping it short, if nothing else. Yeah. Even if he's never totally sure if he's actually finished or if the line's gone down. is it just the Zoom's dropped out? This is a problem, isn't it? The government have promised this for a long time.
Yes.
And if you are renting, which millions of people do, and more people do, because they can't afford to buy a house, the prospect of being kicked out just on the whim of your landlord is a very real one.
It is. But this is a hugely emblematic issue. I think it's fair to say now that the two things that most quickly define how you vote are your age and whether or not you own your own home or whether you rent. The Tory party, when it was in the phase of levelling up and reaching out to the electoral coalition that Boris Johnson put together in 2019, thought, well, we better do something for these people because we want to keep their votes and we want to attract the votes of their children. And, this seemed like a sensible thing to go and do. Now that they're 20-odd points behind in the polls, I think they've realised that the sort of core base Tory support is homeowners and chucking a load of money at renters instead, making life easier for them, is just helping people who are going to vote for the Labour Party anyway. And it's a bit cynical, but then I am.
There was this poll this week as well, wasn't there, saying that people are older before they sort of start supporting the Conservative Party than sort of basically they ever have been.
Yeah.
You know, the age at which you value kind of Conservative values, you're a lot older. So that, I think that's quite an interesting addition, backdrop as well.
And basically what happened about a month ago, the government announced it was essentially watering down some of the provisions of the bill as a result of some Tory MPs, some of whom are landlords themselves. Let's go back to the House of Commons and see, is Angela Rayner for a third time going to accuse the government of obsessing over her living arrangements? And is Oliver Dowden just going to stop almost mid-sentence, it being unclear that he's finished? Let's go back to the House of Commons.
Mr. Speaker, he clearly hasn't been looking up on his own government bills. But let me turn to another Tory housing failure. Leaseholds are a rip-off and a con. But the government's proposed ban on new leaseholds applies only to houses. The majority of leaseholds are in flats. What's the point on a ban on new leaseholds if it won't apply to flats?
Again, the Right Honourable Lady is talking about legislation introduced by this government, which the party opposite totally failed to introduce in their entire time in office. And it's no surprise, because it's this government which has brought social housing waiting lists down by nearly 500,000 and delivered more affordable homes in the last year and last 12 years than Labour delivered when they were in office. But of course, all of this can only be paid for by making sure that we have a strong economy. And I'll tell you, her policy to repeal every single Conservative trade union law in the first 100 days would open the door to French-style wildcat strikes, sweeping away the reforms that made this country great. And we all know, though, Mr. Speaker, the one reform that the Right Honourable Lady would not abolish from Margaret Thatcher, the right to buy your council house.
Oh, my God.
We got there in the end.
That really was all around the houses.
Very good.
What? Wow. I thought, what? How on earth have we got to wildcat strikes? But it was because we needed to get round strong economy, union reforms, Margaret Thatcher, right to buy, you back it.
Andrew, it's like one of those sort of problems where can you get from here to there in three steps? we could hear Dowden's brain whirring as he moved with plodding definition to the next.
Was there an answer on leaseholds? Because he kind of got straight to affordable homes pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, he just started talking about something else. So basically what happened was last year, Michael Gove, in an interview with the Sunday Times, said he wanted to abolish leaseholds, describing as a feudal system that needs to go. That's now been watered down, so you'll still have to pay it for up to 20 years. Millions of leaseholders will continue to pay it. But the charges will be capped at £250. The annual charges will now be capped. But it's quite a long way short of the original thing that Michael Gove talked about. I'm not totally sure saying to Angela Rayner, well, your party didn't do anything about this when you were in government 14 years ago.
I wrote that down as well. Yeah. Time in office. I've heard you guys talk about this before. It's quite difficult to point to that when the Conservatives themselves have clearly been in government for 14 years at this point. There's also, I mean, it's quite a complicated thing, leaseholds, isn't it? And Angela Rayner sort of asking about it not applying to flats. Well, flats are a much more complicated situation when it comes to leaseholding. And the other thing I always think of in this conversation is that Scotland abolished leasehold equivalents years and years and years ago. And so sort of demonstrating that it can be done, albeit in a different kind of circumstance, in a different way. But that's another bit of all of this that often is not considered.
Yeah, but basically you're right. What you spotted there was he didn't answer the question.
Well, yeah.
He just talked about some other things and then went a very long way to get to a joke about council houses. Let's go back to the House of Commons then. This is question number four from Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, I was expecting a little bit better from him today. He seems to be a bit worn out. Maybe it's the 3 a.m. calls from the bad men that have been keeping him up at night. But he also, Mr. Speaker, he also talks about strikes and the unions. We've had more strikes under this government's watch than any time before. And once again, he hasn't read his own bill. Their ban on leasehold won't apply to the majority of people. It's like banning non-doms but exempting Tory prime ministers. And he speaks about affordable homes. Families are trapped in temporary accommodation and stuck on waiting lists. And in the West Midlands, his mayor has used his multi-million pound housing budget to build just 46 social homes in 8 years. That's almost as many as the Chancellor's property portfolio. But the British people know that his party won't build the homes that this country needs. So when are they going to get a chance to vote for a government that will?
Well, I'm surprised the Right Honourable Lady raises the West Midlands when Labour-controlled Birmingham have virtually bankrupted the council, are hiking up council tax by 21%, whilst in the meantime, and I'm sure this would please her, continuing to hand out 1.8 million to the trade unions. By contrast, Andy Street, our brilliant mayor of the wider West Midlands, has delivered 6.1 billion of investment to improve transport. So there you have it, the contrast between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. The usual political opportunism from her, failing to ask about the issues that really matter. If you want more bins, if you want more bin collections, more potholes filled, lower debt and lower council tax, vote Conservative, because whether it's Ben Houchen in the Tees Valley or whether it's Andy Street in the West Midlands, it's only the Conservative mayors who deliver more for less.
Blimey.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, an interesting that they're getting into it over the West Midlands. I mean, one of the key sort of indicators of Tory survival next week will be whether Andy Street can hold on as the mayor of the West Midlands. He's pretty much teetering on the it's touch and go one way or the other.
But the reason it's so interesting is because the West Midlands region is a sort of microcosm of much of England.
Exactly, it's a massive
sort of Labour-run, massive Birmingham in the middle of it, and then lots of towns and rural areas around it, which make up the region.
I think of all the regions in the country, the one that most often represents the general election result because of its blend of seats is the West Midlands. It's the key sort of swing terrain of the country. I've just done a bit of research.
Go actually. On.
Well, when Angela Rayner said we'd had more strikes than at any time before, well, there's a graph here. I don't know if anybody can see this. Oh, I'll hold this up for the camera.
Yeah. Well, hold it up for us so we can see it as well. Yes. Well,
very large line in 1977, which somewhat dwarfs what we've got now.
What's that? Is that days lost?
That's days lost.
Working days lost.
Working days lost to strike action. So, yeah, I think the Labour government of the 1970s might have something to say about that. But anyway.
Well, just for the in the interest of fairness, we should point out that the candidates in the West Midlands region are Siobhan Harper-Newnes for the Green Party, Richard Parker for the Labour Party, Andy Street for the Conservatives, Sonny Virk for the Lib Dems, Elaine Ruth Williams for Reform UK, and Ahmed Yacoub, who is the independent candidate. And you're joining us, aren't you, for the local elections night programme?
Wouldn't miss it,
Callum.
I'm very excited. So what, just over a week to go?
Just over a week to go.
My swatting has begun, but not in earnest yet.
The good thing is I'm not already really deeply tired.
Yeah. You're not already so, absolutely
exhausted. So the idea of doing a show from 10 p.m. until, what have we set it on? 3?
Someone said 4, 3 in 3, a text message to me
3,
yesterday.
3 a.m. Yeah, yeah. And then I'm...
But you're
and
sort
then
of you're... in the groove, aren't you, of sort of total exhaustion. You can just keep that just up. Keep
but then you're coming back on to do breakfast.
Breakfast from 6.
From 6.
So I think I'll maybe get an hour of sleep.
And then I'm coming back to do my show from 10.
Well, I hope you've got a camp bed in the office.
Yeah. Why do we do this to ourselves?
Get Times Radio branded camp bed.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
well up for that.
Sleeping bags. Right, let's go back to the House of Commons now, though. What are we up to? Question number 5, Angela Rayner.
Well, Mr. Speaker, that's pretty revealing that he thinks that housing isn't an issue for the British people, because I think it really is. And people in glasshouses shouldn't throw the stones, because in Birmingham and across the whole of this country, councils are facing black holes because of his government's austerity programme. And I would also warn the Deputy Prime Minister that Tory councils have also faced 114 notices, and Birmingham Council has had over £1 billion taken from their budget from some of the poorest people. More than 16,000 families face losing their homes after the party's mini-budget, Mr Speaker, and mortgage bills continue to soar. Meanwhile, the former Prime Minister parades around the world in a twisted victory lap promoting her new book, saying that the mini-budget was her proudest moment. So since she won't apologise to those families losing their home, will he?
Well, what the Prime Minister has done since he has taken office with the Chancellor is to restore stability to our economy, inflation halved and more down to 3%. And as a result of that, in an increasingly dangerous world, the Prime Minister was able to announce his plan for the biggest strengthening of defence spending in a generation. But it should come as no surprise that the party opposite refused to say whether they back it or not. Because this comes from the Right Honourable Lady who voted to scrap Trident and install in Downing Street someone who wanted to change the army into a Peace Corps. There you have it.
I mean, even on the Tory benches, the reaction there was, all right, is he done now?
Whatever the opposite of a big finish.
Yeah, and Dowden had an opportunity to do what Sunak did there last week and actually properly lay into Liz Truss. I mean, you know, it was politely done by Sunak, but it was pretty clear what he was up to. And Dowden didn't really sort of grasp that with both hands. You know, he kind of said the bare minimum there rather than sort of rounding on her personally. And then we get the sort of, you know, and let's be fair, these are entirely legitimate points he's making about scraping to scrap Trident. And, you know, I did a big piece on the state of the world in the Sunday Times last week in quoting George Robertson, you know, one of the best Labour defence secretaries we've ever had, the former Secretary General of NATO, who said, you know, what will Vladimir Putin be looking out for? Yes, he'll be looking at our defence spending and all the rest of it, but buying a few more ships and tanks doesn't make the blindest bit of difference. What he will care about strategically is keeping Trident. And, you know, there you have a deputy leader of the party who on one occasion at least voted to get rid of it, and then trotting out the line about, you know, Jeremy Corbyn wanting to scrap the army. Now, a lot of people regard it as ridiculous to sort of still be going after Corbyn all this time, and it's a bit hackneyed. They do it because, with some voters, it has a bit of traction. But in terms of, you know, Labour defence policy going forwards, it's interesting and notable that the deputy leader didn't want a nuclear deterrent. Mm.
We should also point out, because whenever anyone says or on the radio that Liz Truss put everyone's mortgages up, people get in touch with me with quite detailed policy documents insisting that it's all...
Well, Liz Truss will tell you that it was the Bank of England who put people's mortgages up. Yes, and indeed, their failure to change exchange rates was... interest rates just before she did the budget was entirely what was to blame for what then followed. I don't think that's a universally held opinion, even in the Conservative Party.
Certainly my Twitter feed would suggest...
Were she here, that is what people she would say.
If only she were to...
Well, indeed.
You should get her in to do...
No, she's in America. She's promoting her book over there.
Did she ever get to do PMQs? No, she didn't do a couple, did she?
She must have done a couple, I think, yeah.
Because she did I'm a fighter, not a quitter.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. And then quit. The following day.
Yeah. Oh, they were good times. Good times. Somebody's been in touch on the WhatsApps. John says, one thing about Oliver Dowden, he makes Rishi Sunak look world class at this.
I was going to say that. It does feel a little bit lackluster.
I thought it was just me because I'm tired. But
No.
I mean, I said he made some valid points about Angela Rayner. He didn't make them very well.
Crucially.
Okay, well, let's go back to the House of Commons there for the final rip-roaring exchange between Angela Rayner and Oliver Dowden.
Mr. Speaker, friends, we all want to see 2.5%. The difference is that we haven't cut the army to its smallest size since Napoleon. And Mr. Speaker, never mind some deep, secretive deep state. Never mind some secretive deep state. It's the state of the Tory party that's the problem. They're in a deep state of sewerage. After 14 years, they failed renters, they failed leaseholders, and they failed mortgage holders. But Mr. Speaker, I read with interest that the Right Honourable Gentleman has been urging his neighbour in Number 10 to call an election because he's worried they might get wiped out. Has he finally realised that when he stabbed Boris Johnson in the back to get his mate into Number 10, he was ditching their biggest election winner for a pint-sized loser?
Wow.
I think the whole House will have heard, despite all the bluster from the lady opposite, not a single word on whether she would actually back our plans to invest in our armed forces. No plans in a dangerous world. And of course, as ever, the deputy leader is always looking to attack others' failures, but never the one to take responsibility for her own. She once said, "You shouldn't be waiting for the police to bang on your door. If you did it, then you shouldn't be doing your job." the Right Honourable Landlady should forget her tax advice and follow her own advice.
Oh, and he's finished again.
I think he's done, yes. There was a cheer bit, there from the Tory benches.
It's like a fairly good sort of AI bot, but it can't, you know, just delivers everything in the same tone.
It learned how to raise and lower its voice. Yeah, I mean, you know,
pint-sized loser.
I mean, that is classic Angela Rayner, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who stood up and called the Tories all sorts of terrible names at the party conference, and lots of Tories got very upset about it. And some Labour people thought, "Oh, this isn't really, you know, this is not how we should behave." But it cut through and gave her a bit of folk appeal. And you can see a general election in which Keir Starmer is making serious points about Tories' failures to deliver, and she's out on the stump calling the frankly really very small Rishi Sunak a pint-sized loser. And that's going to cut through with voters, and if that's the general perception that they have, that might be the most significant thing said today.
Mm. And also, it's quite smart as a tactic, Callum, because what she's doing, she's reminding Tory MPs that Boris Johnson won for, you know, there were lots of Tory MPs who think that they made a mistake in stabbing Boris Johnson in the back and ending up with a pint-sized loser.
Yeah, I wonder what that does to the Tory MPs with an Angela Rayner reminder of it. Does that agitate them into looking less favourably on Rishi Sunak and Oliver Dowden and those who kind of, you know, worked at that time to get rid of Boris Johnson? I think pint-sized loser is a punchy end. Up until that point, it was very read from a script, I felt, that last question particularly.
Well, particularly when she then chewed it up.
Exactly, yeah. Deep state of the parliament, state of sewage. It was just a bit messy, wasn't it, up to that point?
Yeah, we had sewage sort of thrown in amidst the leaseholders and mortgage holders.
Yeah. Was there a kind of narrative to Prime Minister?
But again, that's one of those issues that triggers people. I've got a mate on a WhatsApp group. He moans constantly about the trains. Mm. And he moans constantly about sewage in the rivers and the seas.
Ed Davey?
No. Steve Hawkes, ex of the Sun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very upset about the sewage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It matters. Matters to people.
It does matter to people. And that's why we're talking about what matters to you. And now Lara Spirit's here with the best of the best. How are you, Lara?
I'm well. How are you?
I keep being told that I'm rude to you, so I'm going to not do that today. It's great to see you.
You're going to try your best not to do that today.
How was it overall, the rest of Deputy PMQs?
I know I'm supposed to say that they were amazing, but I feel like inspired by how dull Dowden and Rayner were, they weren't fantastic today, I have to say. Unfortunately, there was a lot of local election priming, a lot of questions about specifically the Tees Valley and West Mids candidates, Andy Street and Ben Houdshan, ahead of next week. And as a result of that, it felt like quite a campaigning, sloganistic session rather than anything where there were.
I just love the idea that people think that saying their names in the House of Commons is going to turn the
tide.
It's
so funny, like a swing voter who sat at home.
Oh, sorry, I thought we were. So who you found a particularly good example of this?
Well, this opened Prime Minister's questions, and I think it set the rather unfortunate tone for what was to follow, which was Jonathan Gullis, of course, Tory MP, Conservative MP.
Deputy Chairman.
A deputy chairman, of course, there is a selection of them. And he is delivering what is basically a speech about how fantastic his work in the local area has been ahead of the local elections next week. And I think Dowden's response is a revealing example of why questions like this shouldn't be asked. And I would also say Lindsay Hall's interventions, and if I'm right, he intervened twice on here, are quite a good example of how his, I think, way of being speaker since that whole affair over the Gaza vote has changed. I genuinely would see him have as responding differently to this question.
Okay, let's take a listen.
Mr. Speaker, I too would like to pass on my thoughts and prayers to Lord Field's family, friends and colleagues, and particularly the students and teachers at the Birches Head Academy in Stoke-on-Trent who are part of the Frank Field Education Trust. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, since being elected in 2019, I've helped reopen Tunstall Town Hall with a new library and family hub, secured funding for additional CCTV, a new alley gate and better lighting in Tunstall to make sure our streets are safe. Breathing new life as well into Tunstall's old library and baths thanks to this government's levelling up fund of £56 million to Stoke-on-Trent. Yeah, but sadly, Labour-led Stoke-on-Trent City Council seeks to by introducing a brand new garden tax on residents to have their garden waste collected, refuse to take cunning enforcement against rogue and absent landlords who plague Tunstall High Street, and are increasing crime and antisocial behaviour by dumping undesirable people in the centre of Tunstall's Sneed Arms Hotel. Does the Deputy Prime Minister agree with me that Stoke on Trent Labour?
God, you know, a sweepstake, and how long is it going to go for?
Order,
oh, here comes a speaker.
It's only Mr. Gullis who's loud, so please, let me hear it.
It just goes to show the disdain the Labour Party had for Stoke on Trent. So, Will, does the Deputy Prime Minister agree with me? It's time for Stoke on Trent Labour to
axe
the garden tax, to take the fight to lousy landlords.
It's interminable.
Order.
Oh, he's back. Speaker's up again.
Order. Order. There is a question to be asked, and there is a time in which we ask it. I suggest he puts in for an adjournment debate. I'm sure you've got the answer.
Well.
Oh, now,
Mr.
No one
Speaker,
down,
there's not much I can add to that. He has ever proved what an excellent campaigner he is for his constituents. And, of course, he highlights the same problems with Labour councils across the country, raising taxes and letting services fall into disrepair. And, of course, he's totally right to be holding rogue landlords to account.
Right.
God. Can I confess, I'm quite fond of Jonathan Gullis. I think he's...
Oh, you admire his chutzpah.
He's a good local MP, and he's sort of getting screwed by the fact that the party's been so awful. Anyway, he took the party shilling. He replaced Lee Anderson as the deputy chairman, and we've had deputy PMQ's questions. Now we've got deputy chairman's questions, haven't we? That was agonising, but sort of bravura.
What is an alley gate? Why is he so pleased to have got one?
I think it
stop people running
up and down.
Passage.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
In the local election context, with what we've just heard, and what we heard from Angela Rayner previously as well, does it cut through when she says things like, because of cuts from this government, councils are, you know, going bust and performing worse and blah blah blah? Does that, so when he stands up and sort of has a go at a Labour-run council, is it easy for Labour to then turn that round and say, well, hang on, that's actually your fault because you've cut their money?
Well, we're talking about the West Midlands, and it's definitely what's going on in Birmingham. Yeah. Is the Tories will say, look at the state of Birmingham, it's gone bust, it's all been Labour run, it's all your fault. And then Labour will say, well, it's all the state, the central government's fault, they've cut our funding, and, you know, they're just sort of both squabbling over the...
You know what Jonathan Gullis didn't mention then?
Go on.
The chippy on the high street that he was campaigning for a few weeks ago, do you remember? We haven't got a great chippy on
was
the high
not
street.
Steve Tuckwell?
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Apologies, I'd take it all back.
In Boris Johnson's old seat.
That's
Uxbridge.
Right, you're right.
Yeah, and then it turned out he'd been on the council...
That stopped the chippy.
That blocked a planning application to open a fish and chip shop.
I'd take it all back.
Take it all back. Anyone else, Lara?
We've got Matt Weston, if I may, who is...
Why not?
Who is a shadow education minister. He's shadow minister for universities, but this is one of a number of examples of local-focused questions, this time in regards to some allegations that were made in a Northern paper about Ben Howshan, who, of course, is contesting his Tees Valley mayor seat next week.
OK, let's take a listen.
Mr. Speaker, in today's Northern Echo, Borough Chairman Steve Gibson describes the Mayor of Tees Valley as having given away the future of the region's children. He was referring to the 40% of Tees Works with a forecast worth of £500 million gifted by Lord Houghton in a deal to two local businessmates. Mr. Gibson, who helped establish the Local Development Corporation, describes it as unforgivable. Will the government finally admit Lord Houghton and the Conservatives have sold the Teesside taxpayers down the river?
I'm going to predict he won't say that.
He talks about Teesside taxpayers. Actually, Ben Houghton has never imposed a mayoral precinct in Tees Valley. Full stop. And actually, at the same time, he's saved Teesside Airport and secured a new freeport for Teesside. No wonder people will be voting for him again.
To Ian Duncan Smith.
So we should point out that the candidates in Tees Valley are Ben Houghton for the Conservatives, Chris McEwen for Labour, and Simon Thorley for the Liberal Democrats.
And the story behind that question is rather more interesting than the question itself. Basically, the boss of Middlesbrough, which is obviously the big football club around there, hugely respected kind of local guy, has now gone for Ben Houghton and sort of have to choose one's word carefully, but he is implying that, that there has been financial mismanagement and wrongdoing.
We were talking about...
And to have that guy on his case, you know, I think the Tories were sort of hopeful Houghton might cling on, even if Andy Street can't, and that could be quite a big moment.
Right, that's your lot for this week on Deputy PMQs Unpacked. Normal PMQs will return next week, but for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.